Welcome to the Agile Wire, brought to you by Wisconsin Agility. We want you to get agile and stay agile. Now here are your hosts, Jeff Bubbles and Chad Beyer.
And we're recording. All right, kick us off, Jeff.
All right, we have Jeff Watts back on the podcast. Jeff, thanks for joining us. As many of our listeners know, you know, you've got the author of the three mastery books, Team Mastery, Product Mastery, Scrum Mastery. And so we want to dive into language and some of the words that, you know, maybe are a little controversial in our community, starting with the word mastery. So, like, what are your thoughts on that? Like, is this an offensive term now? I mean, you have three books with that title, with that term in it.
Well, yeah, I guess it worries me a little bit. So we've got, we're going to have to look at this from perhaps two sides of the pond, you know, two countries divided by a common language. But it's not as big an issue for us over here as I think it is in the US. So it really came to the fore at Agile 2023 when I was in Orlando recently, where it's obviously a southern state, and my limited historical knowledge of the US, there's north-south, and that association with master and slave. And I think it's quite a political topic in the US at the moment in general, not just in the Agile space. So yeah, it was definitely a topic of conversation. Yeah, and I don't feel qualified enough to really comment authoritatively on it, if that makes sense.
Yeah. You know, I think
it worries me.
Yeah, I mean, what I saw, and this is it, I feel like it happened a few years ago now, maybe, but it was just kind of some comments on LinkedIn that sort of spiraled out of control. And I think it was more even around the Scrum Master term. And I guess, I don't know, I always look at the internet as the minority of the people complaining. But it was, I think you have to look to the nuance of the intention behind it. And when I look at your books, or when I look at Scrum Master, right, it was always the intention, right, that it's a mastery of a skill set. And
yeah,
so I usually just don't participate in a lot of the noisy conversations around those, because I think if you just dive one layer deep into the nuance of, well, what was the intention of that author, or what was the intention of the origin of that term, I think it's quite innocent. But anyway,
I find it really interesting. From there's almost a huge irony here, because until recently, the bigger question that people have asked me is almost the opposite, which is the Scrum Master a servant or a slave to the team, rather than a master of the team? Which is very, you know, it's paradoxical almost to the term in that sense, and right. Neither is true. We all yep. know this from practical reality. But appearances and language can, it's a shame when for me at least, when people get turned off or distracted by something which is a bit risky for me to say this, but as superficial as a word rather than the actual intent or content behind it. But I don't want to appear flippant in minimizing the impact that word can have on communities.
Yeah, I mean, I guess as long as we have a conversation about being a skill, like, we use this term all the time in popular culture, right? There's Jedi Masters in Star Wars, there's Chess Masters, and that's been around for many years, right? Like, we use this term often when we say somebody is very, very good at something, they mastered that skill, you know, like a master electrician, a master plumber, right? We use this term a lot, at least in the US, for somebody who is at the top level of that skill set.
Yeah, and craftsman, so I don't, master craftsman, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, master craftsman, and you're a master of the craft of Scrum, and that's really intent, right? So I think if we explain it that way, it's no different than what we've used for many, many, many years. It has nothing to do with a master-slave relationship. Yeah, if anything, you nail the head on, like, they're a servant leader, so it's the opposite. So, yeah. So I don't know. What are there any other words that you think are triggering in the Agile community?
Well, I think to take your point and run with it a little bit, Chad, of the internet being a minority, I think there's almost an element of malevolent fun, or maybe not, maybe that's too dark, but people just want something to be able to have a bit of an argument about. That's sort of
Sure.
a nice part of the internet for some people. And so I think there's, over the years, the word scrum, the word agile, I mean, almost any word out there has taken a bit of a battering. You probably saw some of the stuff around product owners, product managers, with people taking the Airbnb CEO's comments a little bit out of context and saying, well, this is the death of a product owner, or this is the death of a product manager, just because they're bringing that in with the product marketing piece. So yeah, we do as human beings have a little bit of a propensity to over exaggerate and take things out of context, don't we, I think.
Mm-hmm. Especially in the written like word, right? Like you can't hear tone or context or, you know, facial gestures, like all the non, you know, verbal stuff. And I guess that's one of the reasons, like, I don't participate much in the written form, like on like LinkedIn and going back and forth on comments and stuff. It's just, this is a richer form of conversation. I feel like we can dive into the nuances, and this is why we have one of the reasons we have the podcast, right? Because we can actually dive into these things and people can understand where we're coming from. They can hear the whole background. We can talk about stories, and they don't just take a clip out usually and just read like this sentence or this paragraph and then, you know, it blows up on the internet or something. Mm-hmm. So I think the world would be a much kinder place if we did more of this face-to-face interactions.
Yeah. And don't get me wrong. I'm all for discourse. And I think we should debate more. You know, one of the downsides, many downsides of the internet is an echo chamber where you just find people that you agree with, and all your recommendations are based on what you like. So you don't get exposed to different points of view. And actually having a constructive disagreement is actually a skill that I teach, and maybe you do as well. As a team, we need to be able to actually challenge ideas, come up with different ideas, and not just go with the first thing that comes to mind, or be scared of disagreeing or offering an alternative viewpoint. So actually the ability to have a healthy, constructive, respectful debate is a really, I think it's a dying art in our society, but also in our agile teams.
Yeah, you know, and it's a funny thing with how technology unfolds, right? Like, we've had the ability to be like this on video for so long, but instead texting came along and you know, posting comments on the internet, right? Asynchronously, only through text. It just took off because we could, right? Mm. And yet it's not, I wouldn't even look at that as I guess it is discourse and debate. But I think of like the old school, like there were debate teams and you would like have people on a stage, and this still occurs, but you know, you get thought leaders in an industry together on a panel, on a stage, in person, where they can like see each other within 5 to 10 feet of each other, and you've got all the tone and nuance in the conversation. Imagine it like the equivalent of everyone bickering online, whether it's the Agile community or another one, is literally like have those same people on a stage, but every time they're asked a question, they just like type it or write it down, and you only see the text, and they don't respond, you don't hear their voice. That'd be awkward, right? And it wouldn't feel the same as debate. It would just feel like you're throwing things over the wall at each other. So I think it's great that we can have asynchronous communication, but just because we can, I don't think it's the best form. And I think we need more, let's get back together, even at least in a virtual room like this, and talk through the nuance, right?
So I, from where I'm sitting, I would probably mostly agree with that. And I would also say that there are probably people out there that would challenge me on this for agreeing with you and say, well, that's all right for you, Jeff, because you've got the confidence to be able to put your point of view across, and you know, you're not introverted, and you've not got a problem with interrupting people, and actually I need time to think through what I want to say, and I'm, you know, I don't want to be ripped apart in front of other people. I'd rather just post my comments after I've thought about them for a while. And so that's something that I've been pulled up on quite a lot over the years of, you know, that's not my style, that's not how I'm comfortable, so I shouldn't be excluded from the conversation just because I can't think on the spot. And I get that.
Yeah, I totally agree. And this is, you know, I I always like to look at life and business and everything as trade-offs, right? And you can do whatever you want. I support whatever, however people want to bring themselves, communicate, right? But that also means that you have to accept the constraints of the world and the consequences associated with that. So if you don't feel comfortable debating somebody in person and you want to just send a comment out on LinkedIn or Twitter, just accept the consequences when the other person fires back at you because they misunderstood your tone or misunderstood all the nuance that led you to that one sentence that you launched over the wall. So I'm fine with it. I just think it's when people get shocked about and like offended, it's like, no, you're choosing a communication medium that's very likely going to happen. This isn't rocket science. Like it will happen asynchronous text only communication.
I know a few people who are really, really good at asynchronous messaging, but they put so much time and thought into crafting it. Whereas I think, and I'm guilty of this as much as the next person, I just fire something off and I haven't really put a lot of thought. There's a quote, isn't there? I didn't have time to write you a short note, so I wrote you this long one or something like that. This putting some really, well, this comes back to mastery, I suppose, mastering the art of asynchronous communication, putting thought and time into it and getting feedback on it and getting better at it.
Yeah.
I guess it is a skill, but if we're thinking about what builds relationships, what helps get the best ideas maybe out on the table, I still think it's the rich conversation that you have real time because of that feedback loop is accelerated. So you can change your mind really quick, right? And conflict is hard. It's hard for everybody. Some people show it more than others, but like I don't know if it's easy for anyone. I've never heard anyone say, yeah, I love conflict. I love getting in a real passionate debate, and I can't wait to have that conversation, that tough conversation with my team, you know, at the retro. They know they have to do it. Everybody feels that like pit in your stomach, like, gosh, this is going to suck, but I got to say it. I got to get this off my chest. We got to work through this. And so I think it's just, you know, we all got to try, you know, and it takes, you know, getting up and just starting. And I think we get better at it if we do more of it. It's like all things, isn't it? Like, think about releasing. If you release once a year, it's really hard. You break a lot of stuff. So if you do something more often, like conflict, it's going to get easier and easier the more often that you do it. Just like releasing product would be.
As long as we reflect on it.
Right. If we reflect on it and have honest, you know, inspection and adaptation, right? So.
Because I could just go around having conflicts and not learning from it.
Sure.
But thankfully, there aren't that many people like that.
You know, and a lot of times a great facilitation can make conflict and navigate that a lot easier, right? Mm-hmm. Like if you're giving me that person that was coming to me saying, well, I like to think about things and I really struggle to get in a large group, you know, like then I would talk to the facilitator, like, what if you do maybe something like a 1-2-4 all where everybody writes their idea down individually, then they partner up and they build that idea and add strength to it. Then they partner with two other partners and they work together to like get, you know, more solid ideas, and then they bring it to everybody in these small groups. And now it's just not just Jeff bringing this idea. It's this group of four, and it's a little easier to like to get your ideas more clear
and it's safer
for sure. Yeah. Yep.
Until we develop that skill as a team of challenging the idea, not the person, or critiquing the idea, not the person bringing the idea. Then I feel safer if it's us bringing that idea rather than me bringing that idea. And that brings more people in, which I think can only really be a strength in an environment where diverse opinions are useful.
How would you coach somebody that says, how do I do that, Jeff? Like, how do I get it so that we're focusing on the problem, not the people?
It could just be as simple as talking through some working agreements. Only yesterday I was working with a group where we were talking about psychological safety. And interestingly, it was flipped to how most conversations around psychological safety go. So usually most of these conversations are around, as a leader, how can I create more psychological safety for people in my team? Whereas this was, how can I create more psychological safety for my leaders to be vulnerable and to share and to delegate and so on. But that's kind of an aside. It was just interesting for me. And it came up naturally in conversation about, well, what are some of the main reasons that we don't feel safe And it's usually around judgment. That could be judgment of me as a person, judgment of my ability, my competence, my knowledge, my intelligence, my intentions. If I fear, or even what's going to happen next, the retribution. So if we can take that judgment away from the person and simply look at the idea, that can be really useful. And if we get an agreement on that at a base level, then we don't need to go any further. But in sometimes we've looked at anonymous idea suggestion and putting these things forward without anybody's name attached to them, so we can genuinely look at ideas past the person, almost like anonymized or depersonalized resumes, for example, on job applications, to get past the bias or what have you. So those would be the first two things that come to mind for me. What about you guys?
I like that idea, like anonymous. You can't see the names. That's a good one. One that I've stolen for Bob Gallen is that he talks about often is like, just put the problem on the board instead of the two people facing it, turn them and look at that. So just controlling how you're looking at the problem can change it completely. And I found that over and over again in retros. It's like, if we can flip it from like, we're just talking like this across a table, to like, we're now like looking at it on a whiteboard or a mural, and like, we're both standing there in front of the thing and looking at the problem and thinking of different ideas. Like, it just changes the way people approach it. So, that's one technique I've used now often. How about you, Chad?
I always like to, I do this so often, you know this, Jeff, because of when we're in the training room or when we're with a client, but whenever I sense like, I don't know, that conflict, there's tension in a room, I always like to say this phrase of like, I don't know, I don't even know where I stole it from, I guess. It was probably from Norm Kurth's Project Retrospectives quote that we've had in our training materials for years and years, but kind of the prime objective.
The prime directive.
Prime directive. You assume positive intent in some way. And the way I always like to say that is like, very few people wake up in the morning and they're like, I can't wait to go to work and just be, you know, so malicious with my colleagues and cause harm to them, right? And you know, annoy them. Like, nobody wakes up and they start their day thinking they want to cause harm to anyone else. It's very few people on the planet, right? I mean, there are psychopaths, but it's very, very minority. So, and every time I say that phrase, whether it's in a retrospective where you know there's some team conflict that needs to come out, or whether it's just in a classroom, or even just, I don't know, any conflict scenario, I feel like it just cuts the tension in the room right away because everyone laughs a little bit about it. You know, this also comes up a lot when people are really frustrated by upper management. Oh, you know, the corporate and all the bureaucracy and all the policies and procedures. And if they only understood what was going on the ground, on the team level, right, at the water cooler conversations, if they only understood us. And I always have to remind them, like, even the executives don't wake up and they're like, I can't wait to just, you know, spread the lack of psychological safety throughout my organization today, right? They don't start with that premise. So I don't know. I think kind of, so what am I trying to describe? If I had to describe that as meta level, it's almost stealing maybe a little bit from Holacracy. You're kind of naming the tension in the room. Maybe not quite as explicitly as Holacracy would do it, but you're kind of naming something, naming the tension, acknowledging it, and then almost in a humorous way, and then people can sort of like laugh about it and we can move past it.
Yeah. I use the phrase, which I've taken from the world of professional coaching, unconditional positive regard. It was probably Mark Twain or something. The internet will tell you it was Mark Twain. Never attribute to malice which easily be attributed to ignorance. So if you've got a choice between thinking they did that to annoy me, or they did it because they didn't have the information or the knowledge to do something differently, choose that. So, and I take your quote there around most people, apart from psychopaths, don't do that. But of course, I do. Sometimes I go out there and I react, I lash out, but it's usually a call for help or a reaction to something that I'm really, you know, an unmet need. I have this phrase, every dysfunctional behavior is a symptom of an unmet need. And if I can find out what need is missing, then I can perhaps help meet that in another way. But my default position is they're acting out because they're in pain in some way. That's a bit deep, but It's not about me. It's usually about them.
And I think we've seen that. We see that it's very similar play out too. Kind of relating it back to the misunderstood scrum. Like, how many people around the world are like, ah, scrum doesn't work. You know, it doesn't work for us, or misunderstanding about the scrum master role or the accountability. And that phrase of like, people just don't know what they don't know, right? That ignorance. So once they get there, light bulbs go off typically. Like, the number of times we've had people come through our classes, and there'll be someone who says, oh, that person, they're set in their ways. They've got an old mindset. They're never going to change. You're not going to get them. And then on day two, light bulb moment goes off because they realize all their piece of information, I guess, that led to that current state mindset, we sort of broke it down and built it back up for them. And they had an aha moment. And then they move over past it. And they're like, actually, yeah, this does work. It's actually kind of how we used to work when we were at a startup company, you know, when we formed this organization back in the 70s. And it's like, you immediately can turn someone around. And I love that. I love, as a trainer, to see people's mindset. It can shift within 24 to 48 hours. You know, it's just like, that's all it takes. So yeah, I don't know. I think so much of living on this planet is nuance. You just have to go one layer deep sometimes, and magical things can happen.
So I don't know. This might be a nice transition, Jeff, right into the agile mastery pathways, you know, that you've kind of been, or Mitchell Agile Mastery Institute, you know, that you're doing right now, and why you're doing it. Cause I'm assuming that what we're talking about right now is really tightly correlated to that.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'm a big fan that we need to bring mastery back. I think we need to really, for me at least, the impact is when you're able to apply the knowledge and other people's experience to your context. So there's a limit to how much, no matter how good our training courses are, there's a limit to how much people can actually get there and then. They need to put it into practice. And yeah, if they're always going back to a source of expertise, they're never going to be able to actually master this themselves. So, yeah, I'm a firm believer that, you know, I can run good training courses. You can run great training courses, but there's a limit to that. So these pathways are meant to be a combination of training, so skills transfer, knowledge transfer, fill those gaps, give them some more context, but then help them apply it in the real world and help them reflect on applying it in the real world and stay with them over that journey, not just for more content or skills transfer, but reassurance, guided reflection, pattern recognition, discipline, getting into habits of continual learning and reflection, mm-hmm. because a lot of the information just leaks away if you just have a one-off transactional training experience.
Yeah, we often say to our clients, because they'll be like, it's end of the year budget time or whatever, and they're like, can we get all the training in? And then like, we're going to actually apply it in February when we do this new like initiative or something like that, because we do this annual cycle over here all the time. And we're like, I think that's a really bad idea. And we have to tell them that, you know, training is perishable. If you don't use it right away, like, people are going to lose it. Use it or lose it, you know. And so I like what you're talking about, is that you're going to do some training and then we're going to apply it and we're going to be there to guide you along that application, because we don't know what you don't know. So you don't know what question to ask in the training. You start applying, you're like, now I have a new question. And what do? I can go look for materials, but like, I might need more than that. And so I think the model is definitely a great step in the right direction to really help people get to that mastery state. Like, if we look at like master electricians or master plumbers or anybody in any trade, what do? They do the trade and then they go to some type of classroom setting to learn more about the technical details of that. And they do that, you know, for years usually. And so I don't think the model's all that different, really. And if we're talking about mastery of a trade like Scrum, I think this is a great model.
Well, I look at the electrician that came round to my house recently. You know, he went and he got certified to be able to deal with a certain type of boiler in my house. So I know that he's qualified to do that, and he can certify that he's serviced it correctly. But the problem that was in front of him wasn't one that he was taught. It's not in the manual. It's something that he has to use his trained skills and his experience and also his ability to innovate and improvise and try something and work it out and then reflect on it. That's where that expertise comes from, rather than someone who's just fresh out of the classroom and has the same piece of paper, but not those miles under the belt, if you like. And going back to our conversation earlier on about going around and having conflict, hopefully we'll get better at it by doing it more often. Well, only if we're learning. And I'm not saying that you need me to be able to learn from your experiences, but if you've got that trusted guide who's got those miles under the belt, who can help you ask yourself those questions that perhaps you don't know to ask yourself yet, it just accelerates and enriches that reflection and learning.
Yep.
Yeah. And whether it's pairing, whether it's working with a cohort, there has to be some more experiential focus beyond just classroom, right? I mean, and again, to each his own. Like, you can, a person can go to just training, and again, they're going to accept the consequences of, I just went to training. It's great. I learned something. I got a certificate, but that's all you have at this point. And now, do you want to take it to the next level? And there's, I feel like there's always, whether we're talking about trades of electricians and plumbers building houses, or whether we're talking about software professionals, or whether we're talking about scrum masters, product owners, working alongside another person in that same skill set, you're going to learn things. You're going to encounter things. And you can do it yourself too, and you know, learn kind of like, learn from the street, learn from doing it and failing and but man, when you can do it even with just one other person, not to mention the shared accountability that you get, right? Yeah. I mean, similar to like working out. If you're not disciplined enough to work out on your own, that's why some people join gyms or they get an accountability partner, because it just keeps you honest.
Yeah.
Yeah. And having those, I was just going to say, Jeff, like having those practice sessions, that's, I think that's really a great thing. Like in skills, a lot of times we don't practice. Like it's just like game day every day when we go to work or we're in with our teams doing different things. And so when do we actually practice where we can like remove the problem, is be like, our approach, let's look at a level. How do we do on that? What could we have done different? What can I learn from other people that would have had the same problem in front of them, how they would have approached it, right? And so I just think there's just so much that you can learn from that. It's like the first time you take a hard line drive as a shortstop, you don't want it to be in the World Series. Like you want it to be in practice. You want to have done that multiple times so that when it really matters, you know how to handle it. And it's just like you're responding in a way that you've really had a lot of thought into, right? I don't know. What are your thoughts on that? Like, it's like practice. That's kind of the model that you're having here.
Yeah. And there are a lot of things that you can practice and get better at just by simply doing more and more of and reflecting. And then there's a huge element where you just can't prepare for that. No classroom, no matter how long you spent in the classroom, it's impossible to go through all of those scenarios and master them. So actually the mastery then comes in being able to use a base set of skills and your senses to consciously and mindfully adopt a stance that you think will work and reflect on it. And do that not on autopilot, not going back to your fight or flight response and panicking, but sitting in the moment, choosing and reflecting. And as well as those practice sessions, another powerful element of this is what people would say in the coaching world, normalization, knowing that actually other people are going through the same kind of things that we're going through. Mm-hmm. And I'm not a failure because I don't have the answer and I haven't solved it now. That's normal and it's okay. And that's not an excuse or an opportunity to abdicate your responsibility to keep getting better, but it's a reinforcement that, as cheesy and as corny as this sounds, mastery is a constant process. It's not a destination. You will never master this, just like you'll never master relationships or life or anything. It's a journey that never ends. And that, as soon as we accept that, I think we'll get better at this collectively.
Love it. Well, I think that's a great summary of what we just talked about and the need for maybe a different way of learning. Jeff, I guess at this time, is there anything else you'd like to plug or promote to our listeners before we wrap up this podcast?
I suppose, yeah. So, I mean, we talked a lot about training, and that is a big part of what I do. But perhaps the bigger part of what I do is what you might call coaching, which is just personalized bespoke support, whether that be a combination of mentoring and passing on guidance or experience, or more traditional coaching and helping people unlock their own answers to their own situations. And I'll be honest, that's the part of my job that I love the most. So if anybody is looking for something more bespoke that isn't necessarily classroom and programmable learning objectives based, then get in touch.
And we'll have a way to contact Jeff in the show notes, so just look there.
Thanks, Jeff.
Cool. Thanks. Thank you.
If you found value in today's episode, share this with a friend. Until next time, get agile and stay agile.